So just a kind of quick review of what we talked about last session. So the basic question that I'm asking, that I'm bringing to this workshop, that I'm hoping we can be thinking through, is what kind of relationship does describing nature create between humans and nature? So I laid out this super basic definition of description. I was thinking about representation just to get some terms on the board. So if you're going to describe nature, to represent it, you have an original thing of nature, like, say, a tree. So there's an actual tree. And the poet describes the tree using language. So you have the description of the tree, like in a poem or some kind of text. So that the description is not the same thing as the original tree. You have these two things. And the kind of premise that I'm starting the class with is to say that by describing the tree, by describing nature, the poet is in relationship to the original nature. That creates some kind of relationship. And what I'm hoping we can think about is what kind of relationship is this? So the first question, so I've kind of paired this, all of these kind of tangled questions with poetic description, but one of the questions I kind of pulled out of that tangle is what sort of relationship to nature is created? And, hi, welcome.
I'm so sorry.
Oh, no problem at all. If there are extra,
yes.
This is Angela, by the way,
Angela.
My boss in the bookstore.
Oh, nice to meet you.
The big boss.
Big boss.
Sorry.
Or the little boss.
So I'm just kind of starting off to think of, to remind us what we talked about last week to kind of orient the class. So the first question is, what sort of relationship to nature is created? And what sort of relationship is created for the poet? So the person who is doing the description, for the speaker in the poem, and this is a specific term that's often used when talking about poems. There's often an I in the poem, or you, or like someone who is in the poem but doing the speaking, and that's not necessarily the poet. They're often in relationship to each other, and we'll see this in the Wordsworth poems that we read today, but not necessarily the same person. So we delineate the speaker, the poet, from the speaker, but the speaker is also in a relationship to nature. And then the readers who are reading the poem. Often poems are addressed to readers, or even if they're not directly addressed, we're still there reading, like it's a public iteration. In form, through language, to readers. So to kind of delineate who would be in a relationship. And then, specifically, what is the role of figurative language in describing nature? So what are examples of figurative language? It's like a really kind of a weird term.
Some metaphors.
Metaphor, yeah.
Personification.
Yes.
Simile.
This is like my favorite, sorry?
Simile.
Yeah, so there are these different ways through language of saying something that isn't necessarily just the literal truth. So when we say, like, Mother Nature, that's a really, like, well-known figure, right? Mm-hmm. Nature is not literally a mother, mm-hmm. right? But we call Mother Nature, we call nature a mother, and what does it do to call nature a mother? What does that do? How does that change how we think of nature?
Well, it evokes qualities that we then ascribe to Mother Nature.
Yeah, what kind of qualities?
Nurturing, caring, life-giving.
Tenderness.
Yeah, all of these qualities. That if we just say nature, like, we might not have those associations. Mm-hmm. Personification. We're specifically focusing on personification as a way of thinking through the relationship between humans and nature. Can someone just remind us what personification is? What does that mean? It's super old-fashioned trope. It's really out of style right now. You might have learned it in like 8th grade.
Ascribing human qualities.
Yes.
To
yes.
Humanizing.
Yeah. So basically, humanizing nature. So that trope, it figures the relationship between humans and nature. So Mother Nature is a personification. Okay. So what is the role of figurative language in creating this relationship? And then what is the status of the representation? And these are all, the second and third questions are connected. Because if we personify, if we personify nature, one could say we're projecting our own values, our own human ideas onto nature. That's not actually the literal objective reality of nature. So it's this question of like, is the representation objective? Is it subjective? Or another alternative, it's also all related, is it devotional? Mm-hmm. Are we representing a kind of godly truth within nature? Or making God-given reality more apparent, more perceivable to readers? In the 18th century, they called this, and earlier, the book of nature. That was one way of thinking about nature. We talked about this a little bit on Tuesday. So there was the book of scripture, and there was the book of nature. And with the rise of empiricism, and with science, with new ways of thinking about how to make meaning in the world, or what is truth, what is real, people turn to think about the book of nature. The focus of looking at nature and trying to get close to nature, trying to see nature closely and specifically and carefully as a way, not a secular way apart from God, but a way of getting closer to God, to understand better the book of nature through using new innovations and technologies like the microscope, like the telescope. And so last class we saw how in early scientific texts, figurative speech, like to try to describe, say, the flea, Robert Hooke was used personification, like compared the flea to like an armored man with like arms and like all of these human body parts in order to try to explain, to describe it. So we were talking about how kind of getting rid of the bifurcation that we associate with like a scientific objective language on the one hand and a purely subjective poetic language on the other hand. These things are more tangled than we might imagine, at least in the 18th century, at least like at the rise of science. And then we also saw in a poem how poets use scientific language. So these two things go hand in hand. Okay, so today we're gonna jump. Does any questions about that kind of like brief like intro to the kind of questions we're asking? Is that all clear? Kind of clear enough?
Maybe. Clear enough.
Clear enough? Good. Okay. So on Tuesday we talked about 18th century poetry. Today we'll talk about 19th century poetry. So a century later, we're gonna talk about William Wordsworth. And then on Friday, that's just tomorrow, tomorrow we're going to jump ahead to 20th century poetry and talk about natural description in 20th century poetry, and each day we're doing writing alongside reading. So my plan is, and I'm going to do a much better job this time, I promise, of sticking to this plan, is to talk for, like, say, 45 minutes about these poems, and then we'll shift and we'll think about our reading in relationship to our own writing. So I really want us to, like, get our hands dirty and, like, do some experimenting with some exercises and writing ourselves about experiences with nature. And then we'll do the same thing on tomorrow regarding the 20th century poems. Okay. Good?
Mm-hmm. Good.
Great. Okay, so everyone has this packet. And it's a couple of Wordsworth poems, and then a poem by Coleridge, which we probably won't talk about today, but I just included it in case we, like, freeze through and then we want to talk about something else, or you can read something on your own. It's really beautiful. So what do you know about Romanticism?
It was a response to the changes that were going on, which kind of, if I remember correctly, all the scientific things, I mean, it seemed like we wanted to focus only on that, and we left and put aside the natural world.
Yeah.
So this was just a response to, no, this is something, you know, there's much still to teach us, and we cannot, it's not just reason versus romanticism at all, it's, you know, we have to acknowledge what we have. We've gone too far the other way.
Yes, right. Right, so a turn towards nature, or like new ways of making sense, new ways of gaining knowledge. Yeah.
I was thinking in romantic period of music. Mm-hmm. It's much more, it's to evoke emotional response.
Yeah.
It's not to be sterile and, you know, when you think of classical, some of those are very...
Yeah.
And this is very much, and it gives room to the receiver of it mm-hmm. to have their experience that may take them in a little different place than someone else,
yeah.
but they get to have that experience.
Yeah, so emotion, mm-hmm. questions of emotion and passion mm-hmm. Become really important. Mm-hmm. Wordsworth writes, so the really important like a turning point in Romanticism, like establishing a new kind of poetics, is Wordsworth's this preface to a book of poems called Lyrical Ballads, which is in 1798, then 1800 is the preface. So it's like really, like literally at the turn of the century. Wordsworth describes how poetry is created as emotion recollected in tranquility.
Oh, wow.
I like that.
Yeah.
Emotion recollected in tranquility.
Recollected, like remembered?
Mm-hmm. Like remembered. Yeah, so it's the spontaneous overflow of powerful feelings. That's like one quote. The spontaneous overflow of powerful feelings. But that it's not just feelings. Yeah, so what does it suggest to say that poetry is emotion recollected in tranquility?
You need a pause. You need a time of consideration and reflection.
Yeah.
Just like Holden is for many of us.
Yeah. But yeah, that recollection becomes important. Memory, which means time, a gap between. Yeah, okay, so we'll come back to that.
It's not like they didn't have video back then, but you don't have perfect memory. You have specific details that are prominent.
That it's all through the filter of memory.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So in some sense, it's like, not really, it's subjective. There's the
totally,
self, the
totally.
Way
yeah.
the self processes experience is so much a part of what a poem is. Yeah. So I want to go back first to Rebecca's point about there's some kind of problem with the way that enlightenment or like ways of thinking about the world are happening, and that there's that thinking about the Romantics is a reaction
mm-hmm.
against something. There's something that's not working.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what I want to talk about in this first poem, and then to talk about how does Wordsworth find a new model? Like, what is the new model that he finds?
Mm-hmm.
What does that look like? So first the problem. Let's look at the sonnet. The world is too much with us.
Mm-hmm.
Does anyone know this sonnet?
I think I read it
years ago. Yeah,
iambic pentameter with a couplet at the end.
Yes.
Ooh,
yes. Yeah. So what? Yeah. Okay. Great. So that. So a sonnet. So
a
sonnet is a particular kind of form. Yeah. So iambic pentameter. In one kind of sonnet, there's a couplet at the end. In another kind, it's like a alternation. A rhyme, and you'll see that here, that like we get forlorn and horn, we get lee, forlorn, sea, horn. So it's still, it's like a pattern
mm-hmm.
of rhymes.
AB, BC, CB, AB, whatever.
Yeah, so like, you don't need to know this, like
yeah.
technical, the Spenserian versus Shakespearean sonnet, there are a couple different kinds. The sonnet was mostly not used as a form in the 18th century.
Mm.
There's like one sonnet that I know of, at least by Thomas Gray, but he didn't even publish it in his lifetime.
Mm.
Charlotte Smith, there's a woman poet who wrote a lot of sonnets at the end of the century, and people have said Wordsworth really took up, or she like started the sonnet craze.
Mm.
It's a relatively renewed genre to use the sonnet. But yeah, absolutely. So it's a sonnet, a fixed form, a fixed old-fashioned form. Yeah, great. Let's read it. The world is too much with us. Marcy, would you like to start?
Sure.
Would you like to read it? Thank you.
The world is too much with us. Late and soon, getting and spending, we lay waste our powers. Little we see in nature that is ours. We have given our hearts away, a sordid boon. This sea that bears her bosom to the moon, the winds that will be howling at all hours, and are upgathered now like sleeping flowers. For this, for everything, we are out of tune. It moves us not. great God, I'd rather be a pagan suckled in a creed outworn. So might I, standing on this pleasant weed, have glimpses that would make me less forlorn, have sight of Proteus?
Yeah, that's right.
Proteus rising from the sea, or hear old Triton blow his wreathed horn.
Great, thank you. Beautiful job. So, what is the problem that Wordsworth is describing here?
Too caught up in the world and not enough in nature. We need to return.
Yeah, okay.
Or in contemplation or whatever.
So, too caught up in the world, where do you see that?
It's right in the first line.
Yeah.
And then getting and spending.
The world is
getting and spending.
Getting and spending. Yeah. That's still resonant today, right?
Consumerism today.
Totally.
We have given our hearts away.
Yeah.
That is a sordid boon.
Yes.
That's like an oxymoron.
Yeah.
Say more about that. How is it an oxymoron?
Well, a sordid is something quite negative, and a boon is something quite positive.
Yeah.
It's an opposite. They're opposites. So it's like, well, we gave our hearts away to this world, and it's been consumed, and yet we got the things of the world, but yet we have lost that connection to nature and spirit and stuff like that. That's how I believe it.
Wow. Yeah, so we've given something of our cells, interior self, the heart. Away, great.
To the wrong place.
To the wrong place.
Just kind of struck me that the difference between world here and nature.
Yeah.
Having read this, I would think, well, nature and the world, you know, there could be could be the same thing, but he's kind of making the world the things that we've invented or earning livings and things like that. That nature is kind of divided from that, it seems like.
Yeah, so there's this division. Okay, so the world on the one hand, and then nature on the other.
So nature's not the world.
Culture versus
culture
nature.
Yeah, so there's this bifurcation. Yeah, great. Yeah.
Well, I think he picks world in that way, specifically because that's what we make, those things. That we actually turn that into our world to the point where we can't see what else is outside.
Right, right, great. What does it mean to see what's outside? What's the alternative that he craves, that he misses? So we have world versus nature. Mm-hmm. What does nature look like? What does he miss about nature?
The sea, the winds, mm-hmm.
Latency, getting and spending, yeah. We lay waste our powers.
Mm-hmm.
Little we see in nature that is ours.
Mm-hmm.
What does it mean to waste our powers or to see little in nature that is ours?
But the relationship is gone.
Mm-hmm.
When it's turned into a commodity, then it's not relational anymore.
Mm-hmm.
Great. Can you say more about that?
I think just that we are always taking nature and making it into something for our benefit, but actually in doing that, we depersonalize it and separate ourselves from it. And so what you're feeling, or what I feel like we're feeling, and I have actually been feeling myself for quite some time, is this feeling of just deep separateness from noticing the trueness that is in nature and buying into the falseness that is the things that we've continued to make. And the more we make, the more essential the things we make become, but then the less essential our souls almost become, because it's through that relationship of nature and humanity that you actually see the light of God, right?
So this is like a real irony that you're pointing to, that seeing, feeling connected, having a relationship to nature is also somehow restorative, or somehow shapes or allows humans to be humans, to go back to Robert's point about the giving our hearts away.
Mm-hmm.
Or like to see this in the reverse, like without having that relationship. Like if we just see the moon as a moon, or the sea as a sea, as a nature as this thing that's separate from us, that we lose our hearts This is
weird. We disconnect really from ourselves.
Yeah.
We don't see ourselves as part of the nature.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, and he captures that really well in the second part when he says, for this, for everything, we are out of tune.
Yes. Yes.
So the opposite
yes.
would be in tune, would be unity
yeah.
with all creation.
Mm-hmm.
He
yeah.
doesn't name that, but that's what he's saying we've severed. And
right.
A number of people.
Yeah, the sink is gone.
Yeah.
It moves us not.
Mm-hmm.
It moves us not. What does that mean?
We're so far removed. That we,
we're not going to react to it.
Right. We don't recognize the sorrow that it brings.
Right. Right.
The separation.
Right.
You don't even know you're missing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right.
You're just numb.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Numb. That nature moves us not. What does it mean for nature to move us? So that's the negative. What's the positive? What is the thing that Wordsworth wants? What does it mean? How can nature move us?
Well, I think when I first came to the village, you know, my focus had been really on worldly possessions, packing everything, getting everything ready to come, and I hadn't been taking any time to observe things. And when you can observe the things that are outside of yourself, then there's a mirror reflection within yourself that then awakens, and you can say, oh, I haven't been feeling my own feelings, you know, and something like looking at a simple flower is reflected in our souls as being able to look at our own humanity.
Right, that's really interesting.
We're so engrossed in our own personal requests and requirements that we've totally overlooked what's happening to God's creation.
Mm-hmm.
And the world is too much with us, and we're ignoring that.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so absolutely. I'm going to play devil's advocate for a minute and ask, is the nature that Wordsworth looks towards actually the flower outside of the person, or actually the nature that would be outside of the person? So let's look at this sea that bears. So basically he's like, this isn't working, right? Nature isn't ours. Little we see in nature that is ours. But then he starts like providing the very thing that he's missing, right? Like he offers us a nature that seems meaningful. This sea that bears her bosom to the moon, the winds that will be howling at all hours, and are upgathered now like sleeping flowers. What kind of nature does he give us? How does he make nature meaningful for us? How does he create nature as meaningful?
Very intense.
How is it intense? Why?
Well, I mean, the storm part of that.
Yeah.
You know, in a way, it's threatening, it's scary, it's wild, it's out of control.
It's erotic.
And it's wild. Yes, that's
yeah.
true.
And it's really other. Actually, the world is too much with us. And he presents this kind of, I want to be moved by the wildness of the sea and the howling of the wind and this kind of thing I can't control and this power outside of myself, which is a total shift of what those of us who feel like we want to be more connected to nature. But I'm thinking of my own experience here, and we were just kind of looking at the mountains this morning with our girls and just being kind of struck by that otherness and moved by it and feeling connected to it, but also like the distance or something.
And he's, and that the last part here, I think he emphasizes the how important it is to him. He'd rather give up all the stuff of the world and be an uncivilized person who has a creed that we now know is absolutely false.
So go ahead.
That is absolutely false, and that when he looks with these kind of eyes that have not the world in them, he sees imagination and creatures coming out of the sea, and everything is mystery once again.
Mystery. Yeah, so what kind of lens? Lens is, I think, a really helpful way to think about this. So the lens, the worldly lens on nature that sees it as just things, right? Just things to be used. To go back to, I think, Angela, I think that was your point. that's the lens isn't working for him. So what lens does he want to put on? What is the creed outworn? Great God, this is so ironic, right? He apostrophizes,
yeah.
Great God, like the Christian God.
Mm-hmm.
I'd rather be a pagan, suckle than a creed outworn. Do you get the joke?
Yeah.
Suckle than a creed outworn. So might I, standing on this pleasant lea, have glimpses that would make me less forlorn, just glimpses, all in the conditional tense, that would make me, if this were possible, would make me less forlorn. Have sight of Proteus rising from the sea, or hear old Triton blow his wreathed horn.
What it says to me is he's saying, how can you miss it? How can you ignore it?
Yeah.
And then he gives these violent examples, like you can't miss the sea rising up and the winds howling and so on, and you're not even noticing that.
Yeah, and is the sea just rising? What is the sea doing?
She's bearing her bosom.
He's
making it a characterization.
Yes.
He's making
a
personification. It's kind of an opposite of what he had suggested earlier.
How so?
Well, just the fact that we are separated from nature, and yet he personifies that as a person.
Yeah.
So he's trying, in my view, he's trying to connect with it in some way.
Mm-hmm.
So
what is
it
that?
May
yeah.
be. Yeah.
Thank you, yeah. What does that do to personify it? First as a woman, the sea as a woman,
mm-hmm.
then the winds are howling, so they're making some kind of, like, vocal noise.
Mm-hmm.
And then by the end, we have Proteus
rising.
Is rising. We have named, what kind of characters, what kind of names are Proteus and Triton?
Well, they're
People of the sea.
And they're
or gods.
Gods of the sea.
And
they're
big.
They're big.
What kinds of gods are they? Where are they? What culture are they from?
Greek.
Yeah. They're classical. Yes, they're classical. Pagan. Yeah, remember Philomel?
Yeah.
Last time, Philomel's the nightingale.
Yeah.
So Anne Finch names the nightingale Philomel. Another classical name.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So by the end, he's like fully animated, like fully personified these natural things with names.
Yeah.
But I think what else he's doing is
right.
pointing out that Christianity has abandoning
yeah.
a love of creation.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what we've talked about for two centuries with the rise of the industrial era and Christianity saying, go ahead, subdue the world, extract,
yeah.
do whatever you need to do. Turn it into a commodity.
Yeah.
And that's what some of us are trying to reclaim.
Absolutely.
Today.
And it's this great irony or paradox. I think that it's in seeing in nature something that is ours.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's weird. Like, that could be read as a kind of appropriating.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Like
right.
seeing nature, little we see, it's a problem that little we see in nature that is ours. But actually what you're pointing to is that that's a way of finding a restorative relationship to nature.
Mm-hmm.
Like that's really odd.
Mm-hmm.
And that in little we see in nature that is ours, wanting to project, right? It's
yeah.
a kind of projection of human qualities.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But that's what not doing that causes the loss of our hearts.
Mm-hmm.
So that also is a construction of the human. To project onto nature is also
right.
what allows us to have our hearts.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
That's weird.
Yeah.
Right?
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But also, there's this line, and it said, the winds that will be howling, and then it says, and are upgathered now like sleeping flowers.
Yes.
Like, we've perverted
yep.
nature.
How so? Can you say more about that?
We've tried to tame it and contain it and, take away from it instead of being present with the wildness of it.
Mm.
Yeah.
And the upgather, and like the image.
Yes.
How does the image, like what do you do with that image?
I see that as the sailing ships.
Okay.
Mm. You know, they unfurled and furled, so they made use of the wind and then if it got too strong, then you tied up the sails.
Mm-hmm.
So that would have been from that era.
Totally, absolutely.
Or extracting the, like the mine here, extracting
mm-hmm.
things
yeah.
from the earth and in the business of that, destroying what
yeah.
was there to begin with.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. so that there, and there, I'm going back to Sarah, your point about the, like, like to use a word of, like, sublime nature, which is, like, this idea of, like, it's a word of the term, of the time. Does anyone have you guys heard this term, sublime? It's often, like, sublime emotions, like, excessive emotions, but it also was used to mean nature, like an experience that was like incomprehensible, so like mathematically incomprehensible to humans, like we couldn't imagine the scale of like the universe, something that's like not tangible, or something that's in nature that is fearsome, that's so big and so vast. Kind of like what you're saying, Sarah, in terms of the mountains. Mm-hmm. And so we have that a little bit with like the winds and the sea. But then, that they are upgathered now, like sleeping flowers. Mm-hmm. It's a really different tone.
Yeah.
Like, what is a sleeping flower?
It's
what
still
kind of image is that?
Within its sepal, and when it's like the opening up of the sail as the flower opens up like this. It's what I see in my
head. Great, great. How big are flowers?
Lots of different sizes.
Yeah.
Lots of
sizes. Yes, totally, totally. Yeah. But they're generally smaller than
yeah.
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 Smaller than a
sail.
Just a lot.
I think the gracefulness, it's such a graceful image. Like sails are graceful, so there's definitely that feeling. It's also a kind of intimacy. Maybe if like the sleeping, like the anyway, it's really interesting that he is such a like these images all suggest such different tones and connotations to what this what nature can be, that we can make nature, we can see it in all these different ways.
It's like an epic.
I'm
sorry.
I was just going to say I was thinking some of the words that are chosen, they promote my attachment, wanting to be attached to that.
That's such a good word.
Which is, you know, part of relationship, but it's like creates a longing, a wanting to be attached to that.
I can't help but know that I'm a nursing mother, and that twice
yeah.
he has
right.
yeah, the
nursing
images.
Imagery
yeah.
in terms of attachment.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
that's the,
yeah.
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 the
yeah.
attachment, right?
Yeah, attachment.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, so attachment, relationship, connection.
Mm-hmm. I see some changeability in there, too. I think Proteus was kind of a shapeshifter.
Yes. Absolutely.
Oh.
Yeah, yeah.
Mm-hmm. So like the winds.
Oh, yeah.
I don't know if I'm reading this backwards or not, but it kind of sounds like the winds are up gathered like a flower now, but they're going to
you
out.
They could totally.
Yeah,
this unpredictability
totally
of nature.
Shifted.
Yeah. I love what your comment points to is that we don't just move from nature to name it, to create these images or ascribe images, that the images help us to understand nature.
Uh-huh.
That Proteus then gives us information
yes.
about how the changeability of the waves and going back to the sea that bears in the winds. So that it goes both ways, that we can, that it's descriptive of nature, or gives us information. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Thanks.
I see. Though that when you look at the other, it's like here's nature as the other, as opposed to the world, and here's the other, and we're ensconced in the world, and we're looking at this. If we stop for a moment and put ourselves in the other, we see more of who we are, and really. What we can become and what we can own as ourself. So, and what amazes me is that all this that we talk about is all captured in 14 lines.
Yes.
Yeah. It's pretty amazing.
That's the power of poetry.
Yeah.
When you get a good guy like Wordsworth.
Totally. Yeah. Yeah. So let's stick with Wordsworth for a moment. I hope you don't mind, there are multiple romantic poets.
Mm-hmm.
Wordsworth is kind of the earlier generation of romanticism.
Mm-hmm.
And really introducing these questions and ideas, struggling with these ideas. Retreated from the city life. We talked about retreat with Anne Finch on Tuesday. And Wordsworth also, so he was actually in Paris during the French Revolution.
Mm-hmm.
And after that, French Revolution, 1789 to 1793, 1794, something like that. There was a huge, like, all of these people were so excited about the French Revolution, and then there was a huge process of disillusionment.
Yeah.
And so he was a part of that group of, like, the British, like radicals who were just disillusioned. And he went back. He grew up in the Lake District in England and went back to the Lake District after that. Spent some time in London, which we'll see through part of this poem. But it really really creates modern romantic poetry out of this sense of needing to go back to nature, to something like the ideals of the French Revolution, right? These are Enlightenment ideals of liberty, equality, fraternity. They just didn't pay off, they didn't come out that well.
Like,
they didn't work very well.
Yeah.
So the poets in Wordsworth's generation are all sorts of different intellectuals. We're trying to figure out, like, what is a different model? Like, what's a model that can work?
Can you give us just a tiny bit about his religious background?
Yes.
Sorry?
As in, he was for a while, but he left. And ultimately, in his old age, he did return.
So he definitely became more and more conservative,
yep,
as he got older, and more kind of conventionally religious.
Mm-hmm.
And people argue about his poetry as a result. Like, he wrote this epic poem called The Prelude, which, if you like reading Tintern Abbey, so recommend it.
Oh.
It's so beautiful. But it's basically his autobiography. He created the genre of the poetic autobiography.
Wow.
Basically the model of Milton writing Paradise Lost, but he wrote an epic about himself.
can you say what that is again?
Yes, of course. It's called The Prelude.
The Prelude.
And it describes his experience as a child growing up in the Lake District, basically his coming to himself as a poet. He has books on the French Revolution and his disillusionment with that, and Cambridge. Anyway, it's basically his, like, education, and learning from nature. He personifies nature as a minister. But anyway, so he wrote, over the course of his life, he wrote many, many versions of his poem. And people say that increasingly, he becomes more and more conventionally religious or more conservative, his poetry becomes lesser, like less good.
Yeah.
That's a debatable question. It's really debatable. But he does use more and more abstract, capitalized words in the later versions of the Prelude. So he basically keeps revising this poem for his whole life. It's never published in his lifetime. Yeah, so the question of religion, his religious background, definitely was raised in the church. Like, that's what people were raised in. And he had education in Cambridge.
Mm-hmm.
I should check on that and get back to you, like, specifically. But he definitely would have been, like, growing up in the Anglican church.
Mm-hmm.
And then he just became more and more conventional, like more and more conservative,
mm-hmm,
and embracing that later.
Mm-hmm.
But he was good friends with Samuel Taylor Coleridge,
mm-hmm,
who was very, is he Unitarian? He was like extreme, he was like very much embracing all sorts of different religious ideas that were very much kind of based on, like, the God is in all sorts of different things and beings,
universe,
and universe.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So also there were all sorts of new kind of, like, Christian sects at that point.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, but that's not a very precise answer. So let me get back to you.
Yeah, I can let
you
know.
Yeah.
I was mostly curious because the first poem we just read seems to me like such a, I'm a pastor, and it seems like such an
appropriate critique of the church now that I hear in like the spiritual but not religious movement, and the kind of domestication of God's power, and the inability to kind of stand and see it as totally mysterious without clamping down on it. I think people are railing against that in part and leaving church looking for something else.
And that's really what like Coleridge and Wordsworth are thinking through with finding spirits in nature.
Mm-hmm.
Like those are questions that are very much alive.
Mm-hmm.
And that would have been alive with all sorts of different Christian like sects and approaches during this time. Like with Methodism, which was really huge. Methodist preachers and people have talked about, I know that there are relationships between Methodism and Wordsworth, but I can't quite tell you what they are. But that was very much those ideas and those questions were very active at this time. So let's keep thinking about this with Tintern Abbey in terms of how this idea of spirituality versus a kind of conventional religion plays out, because it really is about these questions. So he writes this poem, 1798. It appears towards the end of this book, Lyrical Ballads, which is the book where I just talked about the preface, was like really groundbreaking for what modern poetry does. A book that he writes with Coleridge. It's a collaborative enterprise. And in this book, he has poems that involve all of these voices. He's basically in the Lake District, this very rural, pastoral part of England, which is like a lot of shepherds and a lot of just like a lot of vagrant people because of all sorts of land redistribution stuff that was happening at that point. And so Wordsworth actually like talks to these people, and the poems are often conversations. They're very much in the kind of, he argues that he wants to write in the language of men speaking to men, not in a highfalutin language of, say, personifications, conventional personifications. He rejects personifications in the preface. So this poem is slightly different than those poems, but it's still in the same volume. Let's start. So that was maybe more of a, hopefully that was not too overwhelming. Let's read the first stanza, and let's go 10 lines by 10 lines. Actually, let's do that. And can we start with Wayne? Would you like to pick up?
I'm not sure where you're starting.
Yes, so we're reading the second page of your handout,
and
it's 5 years have passed.
5 years have passed. 5 summers with the length of 5 long winters, and again I hear these waters rolling from their mountain springs with a sweet inland murmur. Once again do I behold these steep and lofty cliffs, which on a wild, secluded scene impress thoughts of more deep seclusion and connect the landscapes with the quiet of the sky. The day is come when I am again repose here under this dark sycamore and view the plots of cottage ground, these orchard tufts, which at this season, with their unripe fruits among the woods and copses, lose themselves.
Great. Dennis, right?
Nor with their green and simple hue disturb the wild green landscape. Once again I see these hedgerows, hardly hedgerows, little lines of sportive wood run wild, these pastoral farms green to the very door, and wreaths of smoke sent up in silence from among the trees. With some uncertain notice, as might seem, of vagrant dwellers in the houseless woods, or of some hermit's cave, where by his fire the hermit sits alone.
Great, thank you. Okay, so how does Wordsworth create this scene for us? First of all, what's the situation that he lays out?
He's reflecting 5 years back.
Great.
It's been 5 years since he's seen any of this.
Great, and where is he now?
It says once again, so he's back.
He's once again back to this place that he was at before but hasn't been for 5 years. Yeah. And do we know what this place is?
The Banks of Judgment.
What? Yes! Yeah. He tells us in the title.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Lines written a few miles above Tintern Abbey on revisiting the banks of the Wye during a tour.
Yeah.
Yeah. This is not, like, this is slightly different than a nocturnal reverie.
Yeah.
Oh.
Right? That's what we read on Tuesday, a nocturnal reverie.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, so immediately we know where we are. We're in a specific place.
Mm-hmm.
And that he is coming. We have a narrator. We have a speaker. He is coming back here after 5 years. How does he set the scene for us? And one way to ask that question is, what are the signs of the speaker who's viewing? And what are the signs of nature as active or passive? Like, is nature active or is the speaker active looking at nature? Does that make sense?
I think both too.
Yeah, can you point to places? Where do you see one or the other or both?
So he says at the very beginning, again, I hear these waters. And then he says, so he's hearing,
yeah.
He's listening.
Great.
Rolling from their mountain springs with a sweet
yeah.
little murmur. Crying, you know, making a sound, voicing.
They're voicing.
Yeah.
They're rolling,
yeah.
They're murmuring.
And he's observing this, the wild, secluded scene, where he's seeing this landscape. So he's an observer
right.
of this place.
I
yeah.
describing
here.
Right, I repose
right.
under
I
a
repose.
Dark sycamore.
Yeah.
We
right.
all can sit under a tree.
Remember
yeah.
how in the Anne Finch poem, Finch often used a passive voice.
Yes.
Right? We didn't get a lot of I until
no.
the very end
yeah.
of the poem. Here, we have a lot of I.
Mm-hmm.
I hear. He is not
yeah.
afraid to claim.
Mm-hmm.
Here I am hearing.
Yes.
Do I behold
voice.
The active voice? Okay, but once again, do I behold these steep and lofty cliffs,
mm-hmm.
which on a wild, secluded scene impress thoughts of more deep seclusion?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so Wordsworth is thinking,
mm-hmm.
right? He has these thoughts. How does he get these thoughts?
By looking at nature.
By looking
at
nature.
Cliffs.
Okay,
cliffs.
Who is active here in giving him these thoughts?
Nature.
Mm-hmm.
How so? Where do you see that? What verb do we have?
Impress thoughts.
And connect.
Mm-hmm. And connect.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And connect.
Yes. Who is impressing whom?
Nature is impressing.
Yeah. Yeah. What part of nature? So once again,
those cliffs.
Do I behold? Yeah, so he's seeing the cliffs. Behold, these steep and lofty cliffs, which on a wild, secluded scene, impress thoughts of more deep seclusion. Yeah. So the scene is secluded. And the thoughts? What are the thoughts of?
More seclusion.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah.
Yeah, also connection.
And
yeah,
also
the
connection.
The connect word is what I saw too.
Yeah. Yeah, so remember emotion recollected in tranquility.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So what even here in the first few lines, how is he's suggesting a method, like a way that memory works.
Mm-hmm.
How does memory work here? How does nature act upon us?
It reminds us.
Yeah, it reminds us. What else? Great.
Well, he's using words like secluded
yeah.
and quiet.
Yeah.
Some very, what's the word I'm trying to think of?
Calm.
I want to say calm words, but that's, that again.
Well, they're very evocative.
Mm-hmm.
They set a scene.
Yes.
Well, it leaves it in a setting where he reposes. He used the word repose, so it has an effect on him. He responds
mm-hmm.
to it.
Mm-hmm.
Stirs emotion.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I really like how Jackie and Marcy are both talking about the same thing but in slightly different ways. That on the one hand, he's reposing. That he's passive here,
mm-hmm.
and the quiet, the calm,
mm-hmm.
the tranquility, the seclusion, all of these words suggest a kind of quietness, a stillness.
Mm-hmm.
But then also he's composing a scene.
Mm-hmm.
He's creating a scene for us.
Mm-hmm.
So in that sense, is he active or passive?
He's active.
He's writing. Yeah, he's writing this poem.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So there's this really interesting relation, like connection here between both active and passive work.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Okay. I want to skip ahead We're going to go over my 3 o'clock mark just a teeny bit. After my promise to you. Sorry about that. But, okay, so he talks about, he's talking about his experience in the city and he's coming back, how he owes to these images originally, tranquil restoration. He's talking about, like, how oft have I turned to thee, O river. So he's like, he's basically like thanking the world for what it's given him or recognizing that. And then he talks about his childhood and like how he now has a different, so, and as a child, he was like haunted, like a passion, the call, I'm just kind of skimming quickly the next couple of stanzas. So he was like immediately affected by nature in these like pretty visceral ways. Mm-hmm. But now he says that time is past, mm-hmm. and all its aching joys are now no more, mm-hmm. and all its dizzy raptures. Not for this faint eye, nor mourn, nor murmur. Okay, so let's read the end of that stanza. I'm at 87. And let's see, where did we pick
line
up?
87?
At line 87, which is just the next page of your handout. So it's page 330. So it should be just the next page. If you, yeah? So if you look on the left, there are like these line numbers, and it's line 87 of those. So not for this faint eye. And would anyone like to read? Anyone like really eager to read? I can keep moving if not.
What's the sentence start?
Not for this faint eye. Do you all see that? It's right before the lose heart little bit. Cool. So let's, like, if you, as we read this, we're just going to talk quickly about it. We're not going to have a ton of time. But if you can think about what is he, what kind of relationship to nature is he turning to or creating or finding after the problem of the, like, in relation to the problem he's described in the sonnet? Yeah, okay.
We're starting
not for this faint eye, at 87, or 86 to 87. Yeah. Oh, yeah, Rebecca, great, go ahead, that's perfect. And then if you read like 10 lines and then we'll shift, great.
Not for this faint eye, nor not mourn, nor murmur, other gifts have followed. For such loss, I would believe, abundant, incompetent recompense. I'm sorry.
So basically what he's saying, I'm just going to stop you for 1 minute. So basically what he's saying is like that experience of nature as a child that was immediate, visceral, this haunting, like a passion, that's gone. That now is no more. But for that experience, there's something else in its place. Abundant recompense. And so now we're going to find out like what that experience is that's in its place. It's like a kind of recompense for what has been lost. Okay, great.
For I have learned to look on nature, nor not as in the hour of thoughtless youth, but hearing oftentimes the still and music of humanity, not harsh, not grating, though of ample power, to chasten and subdue, and I have felt a presence that disturbs me with the joy of elevated thoughts, a sense sublime of something far more deeply interviews.
Great, let's shift. Thank you. Julia, do you want to pick up?
Whose dwelling is the light of setting suns, and the round ocean, and the living air, and the blue sky, and in the mind of man a motion and a spirit that impels all thinking things, all objects of all thought, and rolls through all things. Therefore am I still a lover of the meadows and the woods and mountains and of all that we behold from this green earth, of all the mighty world of eye and ear, both what they have created and what perceive, well pleased to recognize in nature and the language of the sense, the anchor of my purest thoughts, the nurse, the guide, the guardian of my heart, and soul of all my moral being.
Great, thank you. So what is the abundant recompense that he finds?
He becomes a lover.
Mm-hmm. Can you say more about that?
Just that he has a deeper connection, mm-hmm. and it's like a chosen connection rather than one that was a given mm-hmm. connection.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like he's returning to his relationship with nature because of that separateness.
that that separateness gives him a gift of desire for the reconnection. And then out of that choice, that desire and choice, you can see nature renewed not only in the exterior, but in the interior.
Mm-hmm. In the interior. Mm-hmm. Where do you, that's great. Where do you see in the interior? So it's,
well,
outside and also
far
inside.
More deeply interfused.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
It's almost like he walks around this kind of noisy, sad
mm-hmm.
world
mm-hmm.
with this inner source.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And where does the
mm-hmm.
inner source come from?
Mm-hmm. Memory.
Memory. Yeah.
Deeper than memory.
Yeah, it says,
yeah.
I have felt a presence. That's
yeah.
not
yeah.
memory.
That's
yeah.
felt,
yeah.
I have felt a presence that disturbs me.
Mm-hmm.
With
and
the
guide, guardian of my heart and soul
yeah.
of all my moral being.
It's a new kind of morality.
Mm-hmm.
He's claiming a pretty radical claim. Yeah, that there's something deeply moral in experiences of nature.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah, so this interfusion. Something far more deeply interfused
well,
that Marcy described.
He even almost states it really baldly and boldly
yeah.
to me when
great.
He says, well pleased to recognize in nature and the language of the sense.
Yes.
The anchor of my purest thoughts, the nurse, the guide, the guardian of my heart and soul of all my moral being. So he says, in well pleased to recognize in nature and
yeah.
the language of the sense.
Yeah. Yeah.
Which anchors him.
Very concise.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that he's like creating a kind of kernel.
Yeah.
Of like, what is this new, what is this philosophy?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
To recognize in nature
mm-hmm.
and the sense.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. How is this moral? What's moral about the sense of sense
mm-hmm.
perceptions? And recognizing in nature. Like, what does he recognize? I have felt a presence that disturbs me with the joy. What is this presence?
Mm-hmm.
The joy of elevated thoughts. A sense of I'm something far more deeply interfused whose dwelling, it's pretty abstract, right?
Mm-hmm.
Whose dwelling is the light of setting suns and the round ocean and the living air and the blue sky and like a lot of things.
Mm-hmm.
And in the mind of man. Excuse me, emotion. Okay, so what is the list that he's just given? What's the list? What has he listed?
It's more, everything's more intense, kind of.
Oh.
He feels it
yeah,
more.
Great. Yeah, what
the
kinds of things?
The place where this presence lives.
Yeah,
the
places.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and that going back to, I think Robert, this was your point, like outside and inside.
Mm-hmm.
Someone else said inside. And so I think, wait, Angela, yes, thank you. Yeah, so it's all these things outside. Is the whose dwelling is the light, the setting suns, the round ocean, living air, blue sky, and in the mind of man. Okay, so now what is it? Emotion, we've learned where it is, right, where it dwells. Now, emotion and a spirit that impels all thinking things. Okay, what's a thinking thing?
A sentient being.
Yeah, what else? What other words do we have for thinking things?
Thinking things.
People?
Humans.
People?
Mm-hmm.
It's a weird way to talk about people, right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
As a thing?
Yes.
It's weird. All thinking things. All objects of all thought. So it's not just the things that think.
Yes. What we think about it.
It's the things that are thought.
The things that are thought. So we have this, like, we talked about the mixing up of subject and object relationship. You talked about this, Robert, so beautifully in the sonnet.
Mm-hmm.
And again, we have this, that, like, this is true of all these things. It's not like subjects we can think and then there are these things that don't do anything.
Mm-hmm.
Like, no, this motion and spirit impels both the thinking things and the objects of the thought, like, both of these things.
Mm-hmm.
And rolls through all things. Do you remember that word roll? We've seen that before in this poem.
Yes.
What else rolls in this poem?
The water's rolling.
Yeah, so we've moved from the actual waters, like physical waters,
mm-hmm.
to this pretty...
All things.
Yeah.
It's not just
all things.
What you see out there in nature.
Totally. And even we're also thinking,
mm-hmm.
we're also things. that are propelled, impelled. Yeah.
It's like I see the ocean of the spirit rolling through everything, and everything is immersed. It's all there.
Right. And that this experience, this knowledge, this new understanding isn't just abstract, right? That going back to Joan, your comment about the sense experience. Is that, did you say that? Or Jackie?
Yeah.
Maybe Jackie said, sorry.
That's all right.
He returns at the very end of this pretty broad, pretty big statement to nature, the language of the sense, the anchor of my purest thoughts.
And
okay.
Because he calls humans thinking things, it seems to me like there's more of a connection with nature. We're not above it, but we're just part of it.
Yeah, so we talked about the inferior world last time,
yeah.
Right? You brought up this really, really great question about Anne Finch, this poet we talked about, 18th century poet we talked about 2 days ago. Anne Finch talking about the inferior world as like the soul, or the soul recognizes herself in the inferior world.
Mm-hmm.
And you asked about this term of like the moral connotations, right? Of like the inferior would seem to be lesser.
Pejorative.
Yeah, pejorative. Totally. So what do we see here with Wordsworth? I mean, your comment points to, like, Wordsworth is really messing up this Platonic hierarchy.
Yeah.
If we're thinking about like Bible study and the Platonic hierarchy, right?
Yeah.
Wow, he's really dismantling it.
Yes.
Yeah. If to call humans a thing, like, that's really disorienting. Quick note, we're not going to have time to read the last stanza, but I think it's really important that in the last stanza, so at 120, just a little bit below, he says, "Oh, yet a little while may I behold in thee what I was once, my dear, dear sister. And this prayer I make, knowing that nature never did despair to the heart that loved her," etc. What happens at the end of this poem? Is it just a poem about Wordsworth talking about and to nature? Like, we do have, he's addressing the Sylvan Wye, right, this river. So he is addressing nature. Who else is he addressing at the end of this poem? He's addressing his sister. Yeah, his sister Dorothy, who took long, long walks with him through the Lake District and was here on this trip to Tintern Abbey with him. People argue, oh, Wordsworth is solipsistic. He's just, like, all self-enclosed. He's not talking about the people who are actually, the vagrants, right? But, like, a counter-argument is that at the end of the poem, he turns to his sister. That this is not just a poem about a male poet and nature. It's a poem about human relationships too. So I just want to, like, quickly note that the last gesture of this poem is, like, not this highfalutin, you know, and therefore have I learned this huge thing. It's like, I want this experience for you too, my dear sister. So it's very complicated, right, thinking about the relationship between, like, gender roles, all of these things, super complicated with Wordsworth and his sister Dorothy, but I think it's really important that that's the final move that the poem makes. Okay, let's do some writing. So what I'd like you to do is we're gonna write based on the model of this poem. So what I'd like you to do is everyone have, let's see, there should be paper around the table. You could just grab some paper, pens, make sure you have, like, there's lots of pens here. You can pass them around.
Okay.
I
guess we'll have pens. Everybody
have pens.
Everyone, cool. Okay, so if you could just take a minute and close your eyes and imagine a place that has been really meaningful to you at some point in your life, like a physical, actual place. It could be Holden Village, if you've been here before and it's been meaningful to you in the past, but it could be another place, backyard, a park, a place that of in nature that you've been that's been important to you in your life. And imagine physically being there. Imagine, what are you facing? What are you looking at? Where exactly are you standing or sitting? Or are you lying down? What do you see? What do you hear? What do you feel? What are you touching? What do you smell? to spend a minute just imagining yourself in that place. What does it feel like to be there? Do you hear wind? Do you hear water? Has the place changed over time? You can open your eyes and begin to describe that place. What do you feel? What do you hear? What do you see when you're in that place? Help us as readers be in that place with you. If you want a way to start, you could model this exactly on the opening. You could say how long it's been since you've been in that place. Mm-hmm. This many years have passed. And again, I hear. Again, I see. How is this place meaningful for you? Help us to be in this place and experience it with you. What is the place? How is the place changing or informing you? How are you seeing and experiencing the place? It can be in prose, it can be in poetic lines if you like. It can be a prose poem.
Does that suggest you would have gone back to that place physically?
Good question. Yeah. Imagine that you're back at that place physically now. Imagine that you've gone back to that place.
But
and
you
what
may not
like.
Have in reality.
You may not have in reality.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yep.
Okay.
Yep, try that out. Great. Let's come back. Come back here to this room. What was that like? What was it like to read about a place? What were your experiences with that?
It was very evocative, and it made me sad because I went back to my ancestral home, and things are so, they're unchanged, but all of the life that my family poured into it is gone.
Mm-hmm.
It's gone. So it's only in my recollection and my mother's recollection.
Mm-hmm. So loss.
Yeah.
Real loss. What was it like to write about that?
Well, I liked pulling all of the memories up. You know, I had June bugs humming and oak, huge oak branches that I used to climb among. And then I thought, ha, most people didn't know this, but there was a huge anthill between two sandstone rocks. And when I was little, I used to crawl through and then you'd kind of dodge around. And if you've ever been around a big anthill, it's got a very distinctive odor. And they wouldn't bite unless you messed with the anthill. So as long as you sat alongside, you could be a happy little person there. So anyway, it was fun to pull all the senses like you asked us to do. And not just make it visual. What could I smell? What could I feel against my skin?
Right.
And I guess that was part of the sadness. I mean, I could take myself back there and then...
I did a revisit to Tanaway River over at Aklialam, which for me as a child, so it was a happy one. And one of the images that it evoked was my father would always stand downstream. We would go out on our little... We'd take our mattress pads from Cameron, and we would all line up, but he would be there to catch us, to rescue us before we could get too far down the river. So
that's
very
that's wonderful.
And safe.
And the smells too of the ponderosa, you know, the pines over there and dryness and dust. And,
Oh, great. Other
experiences? I visited a place that that I went to with my daughter several years ago and on a hike, and I did not put her into this, but it was just some of the things that I had observed up there, and it was a good feeling.
Great.
It was a reminiscent, wishing we could do that again, but anyway.
Great.
I did mine a trail up in Mount Rainier.
Oh, beautiful.
And initially, I thought was reassuring going up to where I was going, because it's a route that is less traveled, and it's kind of off the beaten path, and you actually had to kind of work your way up to the glaciers. But with all the glacial retreat that's been occurring, thinking about what the waterfalls were like at the time of year that I went, which was about this time of year, thinking that, you know, in the future, kind of like your story a little bit, it was somewhat reassuring initially, but the more I started thinking about it, it's kind of like, will this last or will,
should we ever have grandchildren?
Yeah. Our grandchildren be able to experience.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
At the same time, it was maybe a little depressing too.
Yeah, so in this like world where nature was a source of stability.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You could come back and the nature of his childhood is still there.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, places are there, but the experiences, and you know, if there's no water, you don't have waterfalls, so you could have a sterile landscape.
Right.
Relative.
Yeah.
I did a very similar thing. I went back to my child, the cabin that my grandparents had when I was a kid, but now my parents have it, and my kids were there this summer. But the shells are totally different now. And I had that same, as I was writing about the place I remembered and how actually different it is for my kids now, just by the nature of the invasive species. And I got really sad, thinking, is this place going to still be there in the same way?
I came to Old Holden here and now, and I'm just struck by the symbolism of the tailings over here in the reclamation, and feeling myself and I think a number of others being crushed by the world and having what is valuable taken out of them and thrown aside, and then coming up here and having being reclaimed and having new growth coming out of us once more through this particular oasis in the wilderness. And now how I would write that in a poem, I don't know yet, so we'll see.
That's a great question. And also points to different alternatives that we have now that are really different than Wordsworth's situation at the beginning of industrialism, where he basically moved to the Lake District, and also fought the tourism and commercialism of the Lake District during his life. So even then, like, he was afraid of things changing, of this like nature that he loved changing. But there's this real, like, now, like, how do we talk about nature? How do we think about nature? Is it loss? Is it that there's alternative modes of restoration, recuperation?
And I see that it was that's me being a tailing that has had something valuable taken out of me by the world up here. I can come back to nature, come back to the fullness of what I can be.
Right.
So that's what Holden is to me.
I was kind of going with something similar to that, except that, and I didn't get that far, but I was thinking about it in terms of, but if that ore hadn't been extracted and there hadn't been a mining community here, we wouldn't be here either. So
the price had to plummet.
Yeah, right. That's right.
And I wrote about Holden too, about a time when I was hiking with a friend of mine, and it was lovely, and it seemed like a serene place, and we were talking and having a great time visiting and enjoying all the senses. And then we had an encounter with a bear, and that wildness, you know, even though it seemed like a tranquil place, we were reminded how wild it was.
So we're right on the borders of all of these questions of industry and like human exploitation or production, but also like true wilderness. And also the self and like interior work and processing and recuperation. Yeah, it's an amazing place to think about these questions, the human and nature. Yeah, thank you all so much.
Thank you
for contributing, for all of your wonderful comments.